From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our In the Moment Segments podcast. Now here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage.
This week's installment of Images of the Past finds us discussing the development of telephone networks in South Dakota. Enjoy.
In the late 1800s, there was the Dakota Central Telephone Exchange. Sherry Rostern is curator of education at the Dakota Prairie Museum in Aberdeen, and she's joining us with more on that. Sherry, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
SDPB's Brian Gevick is with us as well, and we'll talk a little bit about Golden West with him in a minute. Welcome back, Brian.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
I want to start with you, Sherry, and take us back a little bit to some of those early decisions in South Dakota about connectivity, and who are the driving forces behind making that connection happen?
For our area, we have a gentleman by the name of J.L.W. Zitlow, an immigrant from Germany, to thank for starting out developing the telephone system in this northeastern corner of the state, but it got larger. Mr. Zitlow came over from Germany when he was only 17 years old. He was trained, his father had trained him to be a watchmaker, and he had very sensitive hands. You had to for that kind of a process. But the place where he was from in Germany, the town, was very small, and there was enough work for his father, but not for him. So he traveled at 17 all by himself to the United States and ended up in all places in Winona, Minnesota. And there he worked in a sawmill. And he had a pretty rough job, so he couldn't do the watchmaking anymore. He had, you know, banged his hands around quite a bit. He was also in an accident, which pretty much changed his life. And because of that accident, had to have his right arm amputated.
Oh.
Now, this is 1877. You know, it was a much different time than now with all the wounded warriors. You lost a leg, you lost an arm, you were pretty much done with life, but not Mr. Zitlow. He was right-handed. He relearned how to do everything, and that determination kept with him his entire life. What got him on the telephone bug, honestly, was when, in 1878, he had the two tin cans and a string, the one in between. And they had this set up in Winona, and he was totally fascinated by that. The next year, he had a chance to talk on a transmitter and receiver from Stillwater to Minneapolis. It was 30 miles away, and he was absolutely hooked. But it had a lot of imperfections, so he and another gentleman took one of the models that Alexander Graham Bell had used and discarded and completely changed it, and he had his own working telephone system. He came out first and was in a little town south of Aberdeen, but Aberdeen realized they wanted to be front forward when it came to telephones. So in 1886, Aberdeen had telephone service in our town. We weren't connected to any of the bigger towns, but we were first or second, depending on who you who you talk to, in the country for telephone service.
Yeah, and I want to pause on that story and bring Brian Gevick into this conversation, because the reason that this is always a fascinating story about the history of South Dakota, but Brian, now more than ever, we are thinking about connectivity in ways that are urgent, like never before.
Oh, absolutely, and it's just remarkable to think of how far we've come. You know, from the days when a guy could sit at his kitchen table and build a switchboard to the complicated networks that we have now, and the kinds of services that they provide that, you know, as you say, we really can't do without.
Yeah.
You know, this is part of... Lori, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I just want to make sure that we get to this audio that we have from Denny Law. So let's set that up a little bit, and we'll talk a little bit more broadly, Brian, about what the SDPB is doing overall.
Okay. Golden West CEO Denny Law, he gave me a really concise summary of the telecommunications industry history. And looking to the future, he says he's really excited about how the industry may respond to what's being learned about communicating during a pandemic.
I think if you took a snapshot of where we are today, I think we're on the very front end of a very large telecommunications dynamic shift. So if you go back to using the early 1900s as the example, obviously through the early 1900s it was connectivity, voice purposes for small areas, and you had party lines, multiple people on a line. The 50s, the 1950s through maybe the early 70s or so, the party lines went away, and it was direct connections to individuals, but still primarily the focus was on voice. Through the 70s, through the 80s, and then the mid 90s, it started to get a little bit more into data, as well as wireless. Obviously mobility started to really take off in the mid 90s or so. As we sit in 2020, I think we're on the front end of a very large shift as it relates to the role telecommunications networks and the applications on telecommunications networks are going to play for really, in my opinion, generations to come. The broadband applications, whether that be remote work, whether that be telemedicine, all of those types of applications, in addition to the consumer applications of movies and videos and social media. But you look at the work applications, I think we're just on the very front end of where those things are going to shift to for years to come. And I look forward to seeing that shift, quite frankly. I think it's going to have impacts that are going to be difficult to predict. Certainly, I wouldn't be able to predict them. At the same time, I think those same things have the possibility to be positive impacts for rural areas, particularly rural areas such as South Dakota, in terms of the dynamics that it assists with. It really removes, broadband removes distance as a barrier, quite frankly. And the more broadband that is available and the applications that customers have on it, the less distance is a barrier to things. And in South Dakota, given our sparseness, I think we're real used to distance.
Brian Gevick, when we hear Sherry's story and we hear Denny Law talk and we think about the time that we're living in today, what a really good time for a comprehensive look at connectivity in South Dakota. Tell us a little bit about this broader project that you're working on.
Well, the project is called The Middle of Nowhere, Connecting Rural South Dakota. And we're looking at all kinds of connectivity, particularly the kinds of things that changed and improved rural life, anything from telephones and rural electrification, now up through radio, television, and broadband internet, which is obviously the big thing right now. And looking closely at, you know, what are some of the challenges of bringing broadband to rural parts of South Dakota? And, you know, how are those challenges being met and eventually overcome? Some compare it very directly to the rural electrification efforts that started in the 30s and more or less completed in the mid-1960s here in South Dakota.
Yeah. And bouncing off of Sherry's story, Brian, there are other phone exchanges early on. She kind of mentioned being the first, but that just sort of depends on who you talk to. What can you tell us about that in our remaining minute?
Well, that is true, and that it does depend on who you talk to. There was a telephone exchange established in 1878, in Deadwood, and that was set up to essentially connect some of the downtown businesses to the mines. Homestake in particular was getting started at that time, and so that one really would have been the first in South Dakota. And keep in mind, the telephone had only been invented a couple of years before that. At that time, the White House did not even have a telephone. San Francisco did not have a telephone exchange. So it was really quite something.
Sumont Kidd is a famous author, and Lori is a big fan. She really enjoyed this conversation. Sue has written books like The Secret Life of Bees and The Mermaid Chair, which was a number one New York Times bestseller. But she came on this week for a discussion about her new book, The Book of Longings. Enjoy.
Sumont Kidd is joining us now on the phone. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm so happy I can talk with you. Thank you.
What a fascinating time and challenging time to release a book. And you have done so much because of a canceled book tour to really reach readers in new ways through digital platforms. And for listeners who are in South Dakota and often aren't on the stopping point for many major book tours, all of a sudden we have access that we didn't maybe have access before. Tell us a little bit about some of the efforts to invite readers into this story in the days ahead as you launch this book in the world.
Well, you're right. I think it's actually got a really great side to all of this that we didn't know was going to be. I was initially disappointed because the book tour was canceled, and I just love being able to meet my readers, you know, and hear what their questions are and their thoughts. And then we had to pivot to figure out how to reach people. And I decided this is, I'm going to reach far more people this way. This may be the new wave of the future. I'm not sure, these virtual tours. So we're doing Instagram Live events in conversation with various people and live Facebook events, and then other technologies I can't even pronounce that I've had to learn how to do. So I'm giving my book talk for the Dallas Museum of Art, and the Atlanta Museum of History had an event that was live. And so it's just been fascinating to see all the innovative ways that authors are coming up with. And I think the thing I'm most excited about is the virtual book club that my publisher and I are hosting for readers across the country and really in other countries to read this book together and talk about it together through May.
Yeah. You have addressed courage in your memoir. It's become part of what you think about, as a writer. This book took courage to write because you know as soon as you create this character of Anna that biblical scholars are going to have things to say about whether you should even be allowed to take this flight of imagination. Tell me a little bit about courage and how you have found ways as a writer to bring courage into your writing so that you can have a voice, which of course is central to Anna's journey as well.
I once had some words stenciled on the stairwell going up to my writing study, and one of them was, writing is an act of courage. And I really believe that. Of course, it's other things too, but we don't have the courage to really put our voice, I'm talking about our authentic voice out there, then we're not really writing. And so, yes, it took some courage to do this. I had to scrape it up. I had to take deep breaths, and I didn't write this novel lightly. I thought about it, but I was captivated from the beginning, really, with the idea and the need for it, and it seemed important to me to do for, a number of reasons, and I think the human psyche really needs to imagine this lost feminine in Christian tradition. And you said something interesting, that there could be some biblical scholars who wonder if I even have a right to talk about it. Well, that's the problem right there, you know, is making certain that women have a voice, that women can determine what is sacred and what stories we want to tell and how that affects us. So that's part of Anna's quest as well.
Why do we have so little that remains? As she journeys through this story, there are times when I was thinking, of course that's how it would be. Of course there would be a woman who had this sort of longing. Women have had longings to step into their largeness since the beginning of humanity. Of course here she is. Of course this is how she expresses it. Of course this is how she gets her writing materials. And other times it was, you know, I had really never imagined it. So much of what she does and wants to do is telling the story of other women. Why is it that we have so few stories of those women, of people like Tabitha, for example, who's really kind of mentioned in passing and here in this book has a whole real life and a personality and a personhood?
Yes. Well, why indeed? And I was, I read of an Episcopal priest who, a female priest, who did a study on just how many words in the Bible, both the Old Testament scriptures and the New Testament, were uttered by women. And it was 1.1%. And it was 93 different women speaking, and only 49 of them were even named. So you see, there is a big imbalance and discrepancy here. Women's have been more or less historically invisible or silenced or marginalized. And I don't know that we have a reason except to say that there has been some misogyny in religion. Some scholars have called it a holy misogyny because we say God created it. I don't believe that. But I think that our mission today is to bring balance, and that was what Anna wanted to do, even in the first century. I kind of loved what you just said about, you know, women from the beginning have had these longings. That's exactly how I felt. And of course there was no feminism in the first century, but there were women who wanted what their brothers had, who wanted the same opportunities and the freedoms, who watched their fathers go out in the world and their mothers be confined. I think there were always women who longed for these things and who had a kind of consciousness about it. And Anna is certainly one of them.
So Jesus of Nazareth is a character in this book, and as he relates, you know, as he's living his own life, and as he relates to in this relationship with Anna. Anna's brother is Judas, who is a character in this book and has his own fully realized character development as well. But central, this main character is Anna. And I'm wondering how you accomplished that as a writer, because I think it would have been so easy to look at her as she supported those two people or conflicted with those two people. Instead, I would say this is very much Anna's book. And they're certainly not cardboard characters on the side, but she is the one I want to follow. I never am waiting for Jesus of Nazareth to come back on the page because I'm really enjoying my time with Anna. Was that something that you just really enjoyed doing as well as a writer, to say, this is her story?
Yes, I knew that from the beginning. It was not just enjoying it. It was necessary. And that was why I told the story in her voice, from the pronoun I throughout, because I wanted so badly to give her a voice. And, you know, there is just so much in this story that Anna could have, she could have been different. She could have supported these men. She could have been subservient. It could have been their story. And I'm sure there are readers who would think, well, I'm waiting for Jesus' ministry, or But no, I wanted to tell it from her perspective, to give us a lens, a feminine, feminist lens, through which to look at these events. Now, most of them take place during the years Jesus was not in a public ministry, or not where they are not recorded. So he's 22 or he's 18 when we first meet him, and we see him through his 20s as he develops and evolves into who he will become. And Anna has her own evolution and passion and magnitude and power, and that drives the story. And Jesus will leave the story from time to time. He will not be on the pages, and it is thoroughly Anna who's in charge of this story, yes.
Yeah. We spend so much time getting to know her when she's 14 in the beginning, and seeing her relationship with her aunt and her relationship with her parents and her dread of being married off to someone who is repugnant to her, someone else, and before she even knows who this Jesus man is. We love her and we're connected to her before she ever thinks about getting married. I think that's a significant piece of pacing too, that, you know, we've made that attachment with Yaltha and with Anna before anyone else is in the picture who we might think we already know something about. Before I let you go, I want to ask you about something that I was reading about on your website, and that was that you had a travel journal years ago when you traveled with your mother, that you were able to go back and reference for, you know, some insight as you wrote this book. And for people who are writers and who are writing things down in a journal and never know what they're going to do with them, that seems like such a victory story that I have to ask you to share. Did you ever expect that some notes and photographs that you took so many years ago would come, that you were really writing this book decades ago?
Oh, that was a great gift to me to find that, and to find such treasure in it that I didn't expect. My mother and I did this trip to Israel and Egypt, are you ready, 40 years ago. And so people would ask me, are you going to go do a research trip to the Holy Land? And it just was not politically a good time in the world to do that at the when I was writing the book. And so I thought, well, I'll dig out these journals and these old slides I took. And I didn't have much faith that I would find much, but lo and behold, as my mother always says, there it was, all of this description and vividness that I recorded that I didn't remember. And I even got my mother's journal, which added to it. So it does pay to write these things down, because 40 years later, you might need them.
For many of us, living during a pandemic has become an act of courage and an exercise in reevaluation. We are rethinking how we eat, how we love, and what we believe is essential. George Sakharidis is a PhD in religion and science. He is a senior lecturer in philosophy and religion at South Dakota State University, as well as an actor and filmmaker. Now, he recently had joined In the Moment for a discussion during our Future of Faith series, but he came back to explore the role of religion and spirituality during the pandemic and beyond. Enjoy.
Dr. Zacharidis, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Lori.
How have you been? Have you been healthy and well? What has sort of changed the most in your life?
Yeah, we've been healthy and well. I'm just at home mostly with my family. And what has changed the most? I guess not having a quiet place to write. That's been the most difficult.
That's not nothing.
It's not nothing.
And I hear that, just as a quick side note before we get into, you know, I hear that a lot. I was talking to some friends yesterday, and everyone has an awareness that they have it better off than they could or than what other people have, or that, you know, they might have it worse in a few months. But the pain of something is still a very real thing if you have a problem, if you have something like that that you're dealing with.
Yes, definitely. And I mean, one of the things I want to talk about today is gratitude, because I think that's an important virtue in this this time. Because the fact that I can say, you know, A Quiet Place to Write is my biggest concern right now is very minor compared to the concerns many people are facing right now in the world.
Yeah. Well, let's talk first about when this all started happening. Churches in general are places where people gather. And immediately we saw churches making pretty drastic changes for Christians. This was, the season of Lent, you know, leading up into Easter. And we went through Passover for people who are Jewish, and Ramadan for Muslims. So this is a time of, you know, there's a season to this. And we saw people scrambling. We saw some churches across the country resisting making any changes, and really everyone reevaluating what is the importance of gathering for worship very specifically. So let's look back first a little bit before we look forward and talk about how some of those faith families responded in the early days of not knowing what was about to happen.
Yeah, this is a really interesting point, and this is something actually I have not heard talked a lot about as far as the timing, because this is a kind of a key point in the calendar for those monotheistic religions that you mentioned. And so this upset things in a way that the focus was suddenly shifted. And churches were kind of forced, and synagogues and mosques, et cetera, were forced to kind of think on their feet because there was a lot of unknown about what was going on with this pandemic. And there still is a lot of unknown, to be honest. And so people are kind of adjusting on the fly, but those decisions have kind of health ramifications and as well as spiritual ramifications for people in those communities. And so, as you said, some resisted and are still resisting and saying, we're going to meet in person with large groups and, you know, God will take care of us. And there's kind of a, there's both a political and a religious, I think, element to those kind of stances. And that may be something we could talk about another time.
Yeah.
But there's other groups that went instantly to Zoom or online presentations. Many are streaming on YouTube, and people are worshiping at home now while in a community. And so that kind of has pushed an idea to the forefront that had already been kind of stirring in religious traditions over the past 10 or 20 years in how, you know, social media and technology is used in worship. And like an extreme example would be, in the case of Christianity, the act of communion. Now some congregations are actually having communions virtually. And one might ask if that is undermining the very ritual itself or not. And I think we could find examples of that in different religious traditions.
Right. And then I heard of a worshiping community where they were it was a drive-up communion. They came and had figured out ways that they felt they could make it as safe as possible, but it was very important for them to receive the Eucharist in person, in the parking lot. And I had a situation on Monday, Thursday, where a friend came by and I opened up my door later on in the day, and there was a little package of bread and wine in my front door. And then we had a Zoom call where we all did Monday, Thursday, you know, service together, kind of, and read some, you know, some words to sort of help us in that. So you really saw people kind of, you know, figuring out, like you said, thinking on their feet. Does it, I want to get more to what you're saying about where things were already headed, because we were already looking at, you know, people who were thinking about technology in new ways, who were dealing with a drop off in church attendance. And now this. Does it solidify how important it is for people to be together, or does it push things in the further direction to say, will some people be lost and not come back?
I think that is the key question. And actually, I want to hold off on getting too deep into that. I'll answer the first part about technology a little bit. I think what has happened with technology is it has forced like theological divides between, if we're talking about Christianity, between denominations even further. So like the issue of communion or Eucharist or Lord's Supper or whatever your denomination, you know, would use as their term, and those terms have meanings also. You know, for some denominations, it is important that bread and wine is consecrated and is because of, you know, in the Catholic tradition, transubstantiation. In the Lutheran tradition, you know, you have this idea of consubstantiation, whereas in other Protestant traditions, you have the bread and the wine, which is often grape juice, as just a symbol. And so, you know, for some traditions, it would be important that they actually pick up that consecrated bread, whereas others might pull bread out of their pantry and use it. And so that's pushed the theological divides even further to ask those questions of what is okay and what isn't within those traditions. The use of technology, though, I think for some congregations, it's much more comfortable to go into Zoom or to go online, because in many ways, worship has become more disjointed anyway, because it's become more of a presentation or a show rather than a integrative experience. And so technology pushes that further and further. I mean, the fact that we can have churches of 10,000 people, let's say, and where you don't really know anyone else in your church is a much different experience than it might have been, you know, 500 years ago.
Is that driven by donations, and the more people that you have, you know, the more fundraising you can do, and therefore you can keep the lights on? Is that how people have sort of, or is that driven with something else where it's just a dynamic leadership team and has drawn more people organically? What do you think is driving some of that, the sort of big, you know, mega church kind of mentality?
I think it's both. I don't think it's only driven by money, but I think oftentimes it can be. And if you talk to various pastors about their seminary training and how were you trained to kind of grow your church, you'll hear things that are not as savory, let's say. I think that it will focus on economics sometimes and reaching critical points where you have to have enough money to run a church building. Because those become multi-million dollar expenses. I think that connects back to this time of the pandemic, because I think people will start to reevaluate what is necessary and what isn't necessary within a faith community. Because of, you know, a possibility of, let's say, a Zoom meeting, and we use Zoom very freely now, like we use Kleenex or, you know, a name brand. It's become kind of a thing, or Google. And that's interesting, too. But I think as people experience different types of worship and are forced into their own spirituality, which I'd like to talk about a little bit, I think that will help congregations and communities of faith reevaluate what is necessary within a quote, live experience that we hopefully will be back to without waiting too long.
Right. What is necessary. And for some people, even having the conversation, it's easy to sort of look at a new church, a new fancy mega church that somebody just built. But for many of people in South Dakota, they're dealing with these historic buildings, these buildings that have been around for 100 years, and the maintenance and the upkeep and the size of them. And maybe they're filling that space with a largely smaller, you know, or a greatly reduced congregation, or an aging congregation, where some of those conversations about what is necessary and what isn't can be kind of terrifying, because what you're really asking here is this building necessary?
Yeah, and that's an interesting topic, because that's been a discussion that's been ongoing probably for the last 15 to 20 years at least. Outside of this, as congregations shrank and become older, and also various divides have happened between mainline denominations and the Protestant tradition, you have these questions of who owns the building itself, and then whether that building can be maintained. And as real estate prices have gone up, that becomes, again, an economic question. And I think in times like this pandemic, in times of stress, it pushes the relevant questions to the forefront. And so some of the questions we're dealing with right now aren't new questions. It's just that they've become very urgent and we've had the time to think about them. And I think that's one of those questions you're mentioning.
Right. So it can be a time to really strip away the unnecessary and focus on why are we gathering? What are we? I know for me, the first time I did a virtual worship service, the first thing I said when I was done, it was like, well, if we go back to normal, I'm going in my pajamas because that was great. But what really was happening in my mind was this sense that, like, what is my priority in the past been? Has it been to, you know, figure out what I'm wearing? I didn't think it was, but clearly having that taken off my plate freed me up to not worry about, lots of things. I was able to focus on the worship in a way that maybe I hadn't in the past. So lots of people are asking those questions, like, what can we do without? And sometimes that might not be a physical structure. It might just be an attitude or an expectation that we can drop.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting or a key point to say, what can we drop, even if it isn't in the actual practice, in our intentions, in our character. And I think, like, this is a time where I think people of faith can really focus on building their virtue and their spiritual life in a way that they weren't able to do because of the structures and the expectations. And so if you have those kind of transformative moments where you go, well, yeah, what was my intention or my value before this that now I see differently? You can take that new value into the old setting, and you've been transformed. Your virtue has been strengthened. And I think there's a few key virtues that go along with that.
Keep going, because now I want to know what the key virtues are.
I was waiting
like unbated breath there. Yeah,
yeah. Yes, of course, the key virtues. The key virtues, I think, are one is gratitude, which I alluded to earlier, because that's tied to just this idea with this pandemic. Especially 6 weeks ago, we didn't really know what this would look like at all, and the fact that history was changing instantly, and you could possibly lose everything you had, including your health, suddenly makes you grateful for what you do have. And the fact that you know, here in South Dakota, I can go to the store and pretty much get everything I want. They finally got toilet paper back a couple weeks ago.
Right.
But pretty much everything is here. Whereas if you're in a different part of the country or the world, you might not have access to food the same way you did 6 months ago. And that forces us, I think, to be grateful for the fact that we do have a supply chain that is providing food, or that there is these structures that, although under strain now, are holding up. So I think gratitude is very important. I think another one, and that's tied to it, is humility. To realize that in a time like this, we are way less in control of things than we thought we were. And some of the things that we were trying to control as individuals or in communities maybe weren't so important. And I think that goes back to that, when there's strain on something, it forces us to see what is important. So I think humility and gratitude, other virtues I think that are also important and always important are kindness and love. And kindness is an interesting one, I think, in this time, because, you know, when you go to the store, the way you interact with other people is much different than it would have been 6 months ago. And sometimes when we're under strain, it forces us, we have anxiety, we're scared, and it forces us to act cruelly to people in ways that maybe aren't warranted. And I think being aware of that also is important. And also to think about people who don't have access to your basic needs, how can we help them while still maintaining our own, you know, healthy environment? So I think those are the main virtues I would focus on are gratitude, humility, and kindness right now. But there's plenty of other good virtues out there.
We are going to take a break here just in a minute and come back with more with George. But what you said about humility really resonates with me, because one of the things I hear in my group of friends, when we really take the filter off and we say all the things that are kind of going wrong and our frustrations and our exhaustions, it's a forced humility. And we in some ways, it's like, yeah, I guess 6 weeks ago, I thought I could do it all. I thought I could be a parent and a great, professional, and I could exercise And it turns out I can't do any of those things when I have to do them all at once and all my routines. And so there is a deep sense of what some people have almost approached as a failure or an inadequacy that really can be crafted into an awareness of our own humility and the fact that we never had control over as much as we thought we did. And now is the time to embrace that and sit in that space and think about what that means in the days ahead. Humility. We don't talk about that very often. We've kind of walked through how sort of things have unfolded, and now we're looking into, you know, the days ahead as we look at what does normal look like? What do we want normal to look like that's different and hopefully better or more meaningful than before? And can we start, George, with what you said about people being forced into their own spirituality? Because I want to hear more about what you mean by that phrase.
Sure. And I think that actually follows really well from the idea of humility that we were just talking about. And that, you know, sometimes when we are not as humble as we should be, we're forced into it by circumstances or people. And when we're forced into that, it forces us to look in the mirror. And I think that's what's happening right now with people's spirituality, whatever faith tradition they're in, or even if they're not in a faith tradition, people are forced to come to terms with the reality of their mortality and their circumstance and the fact that things could just go away in an instant. And what becomes important when you don't have, you know, the material possessions you once had or the relationships or the status? You're forced to come face to face with your own humanity and face to face with God if you're a person of faith. And so I think that forces spirituality in a way that we don't often, I shouldn't say often, but don't always get within formal religious traditions. We're talking about, you know, buildings and money and just the way that a religion has been structured in the modern age. But I think we could find examples if we go back far away too. It sometimes brings us away from our humanity and from God because we can't focus on what's important. We kind of have these layers of facade that we say, well, this, it's important to look good in church, or it's important to have the right, let's say, reputation versus the right character. And I think this sort of an event forces us to focus on character, and spirituality is a part of that because you have to look inward instead of looking outward.
Yeah. And this is a moment to where, like, we might have thought we had that didn't apply to us, right? But the two things that I thought when I didn't have to come to worship was that I don't have to dress up and I don't have to be on time because I'm always racing and I'm always late. And when I think more deeply about that, I'm like, oh, that's reputation. She looks good and she's got it together. She came on time. When in reality, I'm brushing my hair in the car or I'm, you know, like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, the car's running out of gas. And one time I left the car running as I ran into church and came out after church and my keys were in it and it was running. Well, yeah, I don't want anybody to know that story, but now I've told it on there. So the humility, like, I didn't have that together. And who knew? And when you say you might have to meet God, we go to church on Sundays, but we often don't want to meet God because that's scary. Oh, the irony of that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And events like this force us to look at our beliefs really strongly.
Yeah.
And I think that this also ties, though, to the other side of it, and that is the fact that because we're, you know, many people are meeting virtually for their faith gatherings, you can craft your image in those gatherings however you see fit also, which is also kind of magnifying the issues we have with social media. And so you don't have to put your, you know, you can wear a dress shirt and tie, in my case, with sweatpants. And
right.
No one knows I'm wearing sweatpants, you know, because that's what is visible. And I think that side of it, I think we need to also be aware of to say, what kind of an image are we trying to put out? And is that the real us too? Because with the concept of humility, I think what's really important is, and I don't think when we're young, we think about it this way, and maybe many older people don't either, but humility actually takes strength to put yourself in front of someone else as you are and be honest and kind of bare takes a lot of strength and a lot of courage. And people actually tend to respond well to that, I think, especially in the modern world. But the fear of that is so great. I mean, it is very scary to put yourself out in an authentic way. And right. I think that hopefully out of this, people do realize the authenticity, their authenticity is important to themselves and others. And I think when you have need, and this pandemic has forced many people to show I have this need or that need, when you have need, you tend to drop the facade because there's a burning need that needs to be met immediately. And you don't worry about how you look in front of others, because if you're not going to be fed, that food is more important than, you know, a socially crafted image.
Yeah.
And I think that I hope that we come out of this learning those lessons and bringing them forward. And actually, the longer this goes on, maybe the easier it will be for us to do that.
Huh. So I want to talk more about authenticity. And why is that important? Why is that so important for yourself first? Why is that authenticity? And what does it feel like?
Wow, this is like, now it's getting psychological. Okay.
I know. And I'm kind of regretting inviting you on, because like you see me a little too clearly and I'm like, let's stop talking. No, but how do you know when you've achieved it? Do you have to is it every day you have to go back and say, was I authentic today? Or like talk about authenticity and what that really feels like and what it means.
Well, I think one, you actually touched on something there. When you are authentic, I think you are able to see others more authentically, because you're not buying into that lie of the image. And I'm not saying I don't do that too. If you go to, you know, my IMDb page, I'm an actor. There's certain images I'm going to put up and not others. I mean, we're crafting an image. But at the same time, I should say, why is it important to me? I think that at a very young age, it was instilled upon me that honesty is very important. And I don't know, I think part of it was that upbringing and that emphasis on character. My father emphasized character very strongly to us, my own faith, but also just, you know, who I am and how I was formed. I mean, these experiences we have shape us. And I've mentioned this in various settings before, but like it ties to the idea of love. It's very important for me to be loved, to be honest, and I think for everybody. But if someone is loving you or accepting you, but they don't really see you, they see some version of you. You as an authentic person or as an introspective person see that that's all false. They're not accepting you. They're accepting some image of you.
Yeah.
And so only through authenticity can you be truly accepted and loved and respected and all these things that we all crave. And so although it's hard, it really is the path to achieving the things we want, I think, as human beings. And so ultimately, by being virtuous or emphasizing certain virtues, it actually makes us better human beings and more fulfilled as human beings.
Mm. One of the things yesterday on the program, I talked to Deb Soholt and we talked about what's next. And I said, I'm almost afraid not of getting back to normal, because I would love it if this virus would disappear from the earth and we wouldn't be, you know, threatened with our physical health and all this suffering. But I'm also afraid of going back to normal and everybody just sort of collectively forgetting some of these things, because we're talking about things more deeply than we did, you know, a few months ago. And on this show, we talk about some pretty deep stuff. And now it just seems like a lot of those layers are peeled away. How do we move forward in this, George, and preserve the gift of this while we continue to suffer? Because that's a really hard thing to do. I mean, we just want it to be gone. We want it to be over. We want to be better. We want the kids to be back in school, or we want the daycare to be open, or we want... You know, we want to sleep at night without weird dreams. And how do we find that gift in the midst of the suffering in a way that preserves our ongoing thoughtfulness?
Well, I think part of it, and I'm speaking more from personal experience. I mean, obviously, I'm educated in various ways, and that influences my experience. But I just want to say it's from my experience. Because I do care about honesty and justice and fairness and these sorts of things, when we reach a difficult situation like this, we kind of get angry and we're like, this isn't fair. It should be like this. And we keep looking at what it should be instead of what is happening. And I think that that's a good thing in one sense, because we have an ideal of justice that is, that points us to something better. And I think when something like this happens, we need to kind of just accept what is going on and deal with the reality of it, and instead of trying to jump out of it as quickly as we can. Now, I hope that we get out of this very quickly. I hope people are healthy. You know, I hope this doesn't have long-term economic ramifications, as it looks like it will. But at the same time, that may be the reality, and we have to accept that reality and give up maybe what we expected things to be like. I'm very optimistic as a person. I have goals. I look forward, and I think we should do that. It can point us forward. But ignoring the reality doesn't allow us to move forward in a real way. And so I think accepting that, you use the word suffering, and that's a tough word to use here, but I think it might be accurate, is accept where we are, accept the fact that we have a chance to be introspective, to be grateful, so that when things do come back, however that looks, and it may look different, that we appreciate it, that I appreciate the fact that I can go for a walk in a city and see other people and smile and wave. That is a very simple thing that we wouldn't have necessarily thought about, you know, 6 months ago. It's forcing us to appreciate all of the things of life, and also correct the things that maybe we're trying to cut corners with. And so, I think that brings us back to humility, gratitude, and looking at our faith and what that means to us. Because in a time like this, the facade of organized religion, and I'm not saying all organized religion is that way, but when it is, when you go to church just to be seen or to, you know, show status, that's worthless in a time like this. That's nothing. And I think true belief and true faith points us to what is important and will pull us away from these kind of things that do corrupt over time and are not lasting. And so by building our virtue in this difficult time, we're creating something that's lasting. By building our faith, we're creating something that's lasting. And we're letting go of those kind of shiny objects that we always are drawn to.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.